Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week, on a special bonus episode of Meet & Three, we find out how Brexit could be changing the way that Brits eat.
If you're not getting your food from the European Union, where Britain gets 30% directly, well, where are you going to get it from? As I put very succinctly, bye-bye fresh peaches from Italy, hello tinned peaches from Florida. Bye-bye fresh oranges, hello tinned oranges. Bye-bye free-range beef, hello hormone-injected beef.
Tune in to hear about the UK's struggle to stabilize its food system on Meet & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. After a decade of working to foster sustainable farming practices, ethical trade, and community development in Africa, Jeff Abella and his partner Ishan founded Mocha Farms in Cameroon and thusly Mocha Origins, a bean-to-bar slash bag coffee and chocolate company that inspires quote-unquote real social change. Jeff is here to explain, well, first and foremost, what bean-to-bar even means, what a craft chocolate bar consists of and why it costs $5, $7, or $10 at the store, and the challenges and unique rewards of building Mocha Farms up in Cameroon. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, Coral. Thanks so much.
So it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, let's start there. What does it mean to be bean to bar? What does it require?
So when you think about chocolate, there's kind of two worlds. There's the chocolate maker and the chocolatier. And so we're both. We're making chocolate, starting from the raw cocoa bean, or the cacao bean, and we do the whole process from sorting the beans, roasting them, deshelling them, grinding them into liquid chocolate, and then even aging them, and from that point going on to the chocolate tiering stage of pouring them into chocolate. And so bean to bar chocolate refers to that entire kind of supply chain life cycle of a chocolate bar.
Mm-hmm. And so when I go to the grocery store and I go to treat myself to like a nice bar of chocolate, and they range from like $3 a bar to $10 a bar, why am I choosing, what am I paying for with that $10?
So a lot of that can do with the process in which it was made, how the bar was made, but a lot of it also has to do with the ingredients and the kind of social responsibility and practices around sourcing those ingredients. And so when you look at prices and packaging as well, one of the things I look at is, you know, is it bean to bar chocolate? Is one company doing the entire process and therefore kind of nitpicking and being very specific on who they're sourcing the beans from and the practices and ingredients they're using to make their chocolate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so why don't we take one of these $10 bars and kind of work backwards on price? What are you paying for? Are you paying for pretty packaging? Are you paying for the roasters here in America who are wrapping them? Like, what are you paying for?
So recently, the Washington Post put out a really good article, and if you've ever eaten chocolate or plan to, you should read this article. We kind of owe it to the world. And they did a great job really surfacing the realities around a lot of unethical farming practices and pinpointed a few countries in Africa and really focused in on child slave labor. And it was kind of a shock to many to see that the companies the Washington Post was calling out, were those supplying the majority of the chocolate that the world consumes. And, you know, when we see a cheap chocolate bar, something between like $1 and $2 or $3, it just doesn't add up. And it feels like great value because it really is. But that bean was potentially grown on the backs of child slave labor. And those are issues that I'm glad are now surfacing and people are becoming more aware of. And so one thing that we work hard on in Cameroon is focusing on quality. And we'll talk a bit more about this, but not so much bulk, high quantity, and more on low quantity, higher quality, and paying premiums for that quality. At the same time, compensation that's fair and really equals what the farmer deserves. And so all of that ultimately is going to cost more. And so when we use beans that have that value and that ethical, tie back to how they were, how the transparent trade happened, it should, taste better, should be a better quality product. At the same time, we can feel good about eating it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've been kind of angling the conversation towards chocolate more, but let's also apply the same questions to coffee. Let's say I don't really understand what coffee should taste like. I go to the store, everything's like around $14 for the 14-ounce bag, and it all kind of tastes the same. So why am I going to, I'm going to pick for the bag that's very pretty with the gold foiling and the blue, you know, which one I'm talking about, and why am I reaching for that one?
Right. Well, if you're reaching for that, it's probably, been branded, and it's like in our consumer DNA at this point. We've been trained as consumers to, look for that red, maybe it's that red plastic bucket of coffee that's been ground for a year at that point. Or it could be, when you look at pricing, though, on the coffee market, there's commodity grade and there's specialty grade. So let's start with the beans, and it really does all start there. And there's the way that the farmer was paid, the compensation that occurred, what was that as far as fairness to the farmer. But then there's quality. And so there's, low quality and high quality and everywhere in between. And the Specialty Coffee Association of America, the SCAA, does a really good job of creating a standard for grading coffee. And that ultimately that should set the price as well. And so when you see bulk coffee on the shelf, or you see coffee in the supermarket that's, priced really economically, you can probably, guess that it's not specialty or premium grade. And the defects you often don't taste because the roast levels are so dark. One thing that we really have fun with at Mocha is sourcing specialty grade coffee, oftentimes from the farmers themselves. And then working with the bean to not muddy the flavor and completely, lose that unique quality that's in that coffee's flavor potential, but really kind of draw it out. So lighter roast, more medium roast, and that's often what you get when you pay more for a coffee.
So we've talked a lot about this on the show. Why pay $8, $9 for eggs at the farmer's market when they're like 50 cents at the grocery store? And what people don't see or are reminded of is that a lot of it is subsidized by the government. And is there that kind of subsidy on coffee and chocolate as well?
Yes and no. I mean, it all really starts with the consumer's demand. And so when I think about like that Washington Post article and the issues that we see a lot of West African farmers facing, there's a demand for that. There's a demand for large quantities of low quality beans that don't have traceability. And we consume a ton of that. And so I think it really all starts with us. So, we're almost subsidizing that by insisting that chocolate is a candy and it should be priced really low. I'd love to see chocolate just completely, disappear from that shelf. If you can't afford it, we shouldn't eat it because there's a huge downside to doing it. At the same time, there's a lot of money to be made in bulk, bulk commodity cocoa and coffee beans. So, on the farm side, it's just kind of keeps the demand high for that kind of low priced bulk commodity grade. And so I think it has a lot to do with kind of us waking up as consumers. We just released a line of bars, and it's four different countries from Africa. We're going to feature them at our pop up on the Upper West Side this weekend, this Friday. And our whole point is to kind of show consumers that these are expensive beans for us to sort. Source, and the chocolate is very unique. And when you take time to kind of realize that chocolate is more of a food than a candy, you start to kind of relate to the price of an $8 to $16 chocolate bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about this before the show, but coffee and I think even chocolate too, like, you associate certain feelings or memories with it, and you expect maybe consistency above all things. And so what is the argument then for trying, you know, this single origin chocolate when I just want something cozy?
Yeah. Anything you can want is out there. And so, you know, even for that chocolate, maybe you don't want something super nuanced or fruity or floral, which a lot of cocoa or cacao has that to offer. You can get other chocolates that, you know, are a little bit more toned down and just give you that really nice chocolatey, kind of those roasty, toasty notes. And same with coffee as well. But when you kind of look beyond the packaging and get to know a company, I think a few things that we're looking for are just what are the sourcing practices that they've committed to and what steps are they making to showcase transparency? And those are really good kind of buying decisions as far as consumers.
Mm-hmm. It almost feels like being good to the earth and being good to our tummies and our tastes feels mutually exclusive sometimes. And so if all we want from chocolate is something sweet and chocolatey tasting, why should brands do the hard work of sourcing better, you know, from better people, treating them better, and making that clear to the consumer?
Because it's our responsibility. And it's something that we absolutely have to do. Without the farmer, there's no tree. And without the tree, there's no pot or chocolate really to be had. But beyond that, it's just a question of ethics. And cocoa and coffee are grown so far outside of our view in this consuming, you know, world here, and at least in the U.S. And it's, I think, really the job of us as the chocolate maker to make it clear what is that story of chocolate. It's, mm-hmm. There's something behind this bar that makes it, it really links back to people's lives and livelihood of thousands. And so the consumer education piece for us at Mocha is really fun. We try to spend a lot of time to not just showcase like the flavor potential of a bar, but all the way back to the farmers that grow the beans and what that relationship looks like on the farm.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been doing this for a while. Before Mocha, you were in Cameroon. You were working in Africa anyway. And so as someone who's been kind of an observer for the past decade or so, what do you think has led to these changing expectations or demands of our food?
I think that one kind of primary influencer is maybe even social media, and just like the connectedness we are to the world. You can now see much more than you could before, and we're, you know, easy to get reports from, you know, 5,000 miles away on the conditions of living and how certain farming practices that, you know, ultimately equal a food we're eating are not sustainable or healthy for those, you know, breaking their backs to make that for us. And so I like to kind of look at the media and social media as in the positive light as far as letting us have insight into these practices that forever we hadn't been able to see. When I first started working in Cameroon, it was in 2007, and like smartphone technology was hardly there. There was no Wi-Fi. I backpacked over a dial-up modem, and I had a little Nokia phone. And but by 2009 and 10, we were able to actually have data plans and start sharing. So we started with our farming networks that we were creating, sharing mobile phones and having apps installed that let them track the metrics that they were using to calculate the profitability of their farm, how much they harvested, what was the amount paid to them. And then our health programs were even using them to track the patient cases and things like that. Mm-hmm. But technology really kind of blew the door open as far as potential for the farmer, as well as for them to communicate to us in the consuming world what's happening.
Mm-hmm. This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
And we're back. Jeff and I were just talking about how Mocha got kind of set up in Cameroon. So let's start there. You weren't doing chocolate and coffee your whole life. So let's start at the very beginning. What happened?
Yeah, it really had nothing to do with coffee or chocolate in the beginning. And even today, the mission of it doesn't. But ultimately, the success has all to do with the chocolate and coffee part of the company. We were living in Cameroon, West Africa, and my wife and I had moved there in 2007 to start a network of libraries and health centers for a really great not-for-profit. And we're situated in this mountainous region, about 6,000 feet up in the northwest region of the country. And all of the people that we were working with and ultimately turned into our neighbors and family are coffee farmers. This community is... was at one point like kind of built around high-end coffee production. And the coffee market is very volatile, a lot of ups and downs. And so it very quickly became an unstable kind of crop to grow. And as we were serving more with our libraries and our health centers, and then we started doing mobile health clinics, we started reaching coca-growing communities as well, and really just got fascinated by the potential that these two crops have, so much influence in the community. At the same time, there's so much inconsistency and vulnerability. And we started a small community farming project in 2015. We called it Mocha. Mocha, you know, mocha latte means, you know, the coffee and chocolate coming together, two things we all love. And it was an agricultural project to showcase cocoa and coffee production in a sustainable way. And you know, I always joke, you have to be kind of crazy to start a cocoa farm if it's like, you know, you chasing a profitable dream. And so that's just what we did. We started growing cacao there to really jump in and understand the problem even more. We started it around a farmer field school that is open to the other cocoa farmers in the area to come in and see what practices we're using and equally learn a ton from everyone else that's there. And so, you know, it's me and a local community of Cameroonian agronomists and agricultural technicians and just cocoa farmers working through best practices to kind of figure out what pinch points along their cocoa supply chain we can work to improve for them. And you know, I want to add one thing is the cocoa quality there, it's really good, but the world doesn't know it for quality, and it's a bulk commodity. And so when we look at, you know, when we look at pricing, when I joked about being crazy to start a cocoa farm there, it's because there's not a lot of awareness around fine flavored cocoa, and farmers are not getting paid a high price for premium cocoa. The training and the knowledge actually isn't even in this community to grow that. It's let's focus in on quantity, and when the time of year comes, when the buyers come in, let's liquidate whatever pods we have on our tree and earn very little for our hard work. And so what we've slowly started to do is teach quality cocoa production. And we've done it ourselves the hard way to showcase that, all the way from harvesting and fermentation and drying, and even then what kind of varieties we're planting, what kind of crop, you know, varietals are we using. And then crop diversification, so growing bananas and plantain, mangoes, papayas, avocados, other things to kind of help farmers diversify their risk a little bit. And on the ecosystem of it all, there's a lot of that intercropping model is very advantageous. You have banana trees growing, you know, within a year we can harvest the banana. that banana tree is then shading a cocoa tree that won't be ready to produce anything of value till about 4 to 5 years. So there's a nice relationship between those two crops, mm-hmm. at the same time teaching how to grow even more valuable tree crops.
Yeah. So even before you were involved, those farmers were already growing cacao?
Correct.
Okay. And so, I mean, hard questions, but how do you then navigate coming in with like almost a savior complex, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I never thought of it that way, because we were literally living there and part of this community. And it was me and my friend Edwin that started this farm. Edwin's a Cameroonian, and it was never really a foreign entity coming in. It's actually a local Cameroonian-based company. Just a few of us that started very small on this farm. The local government granted the land for it, and the neighboring communities were really supportive of it. So I think the whole idea was, and still isn't, to showcase what others should be doing. It's working with them to trial other kind of practices that the more developed cocoa growing communities around mm-hmm. the world are doing successfully. Mm-hmm. And asking a farmer to do that blindly is crazy, you know, and we would never do that. But trying it ourselves has been a really great way to showcase what works and also what doesn't. And then collaboratively with the community members, identify potential solutions.
Mm-hmm. So was it that the farmers there would kind of think like, we really want to do this with our cacao, but we just don't have the resources. We don't have, just a lot of the general setup to do that. Or is it like, we don't even know where to begin?
It's both. Plus it's, we really want to sell our cocoa for more money. Uh-huh. And it's just not worth more money until you put in some different techniques and practices. So like the fermentation is a great example. A cocoa pod grows on a tree, and when it's first harvested, the fermentation step is really critical to getting it to the point of being a good quality bean, which will make good quality chocolate. And when that practice isn't taught, it's really hard, or actually when someone's not paying against that better quality fermentation. Mm-hmm.
Which also takes extra time.
It takes extra time, effort, and knowledge. Then what's the point of even doing it? Mm-hmm. And when the majority of a country is selling to maybe two or three of the huge chocolate companies in the world that are making chocolate from commodity beans, and such a low percentage of their chocolate is actually cocoa, you're not going to taste the defective bean, so it doesn't matter. And farmers can sell it quickly. They sell it very, very cheaply, however. So what we started to do was work with farmers to say, you know, let's keep doing that, but let's take, you know, maybe 1 acre, or, you know, it might be 1 ton, and do a better job fermenting, a better job drying, and double picking, and really keeping that lot of cocoa separate. And so we started then making chocolate collaboratively together over there in these small grinders that we brought over, and together can taste the difference. And when we see that the quality is better, we pay against quality. So there's never, it's not a donation or a handout. It's really showcasing that quality deserves a higher price. And when you achieve that, you can be paid for that. And so we're trying to, really work in that direction where it's, you're getting paid for the extra value that you're adding.
Mm-hmm. And so, how much of their chocolate is divided between the commodity bulk crop versus, you know, the more premium time-intensive kind?
In Cameroon, it's huge. It's in the, 90% or more is just commodity grade.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's slowly growing, but still 10% or so.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of work to do, right. and a lot of the world does too. Mm-hmm. And what I thought, it's been really fun the last decade seeing the craft chocolate industry pop up in America. Mm-hmm. We're actually, as a whole, working together to kind of push shelf space, steal some market share from these big bulk chocolate companies. Mm-hmm. And, and it all starts with us as consumers, though, understanding what that even means. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think the, opportunities like this to tell that story, to really share about what it means to make quality chocolate all the way and link that back to the farming practices. It really has to start with the education.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like that 90-10 split is like a direct reflection of what the market wants.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's talk about this, like, you select 1 acre and you are putting more time into it. You're putting more care. And so you did this taste test, and like, what, describe some of these taste differences and how we might be able to pick them out. Like when we try like a 50 cent piece of chocolate.
Well, so you'll taste in a 50 cent or a dollar bar. You're just going to taste a lot of sugar, and it's really fun to do this. So get a nice, good quality dark chocolate bar from a company.
Mocha Oranges.
You can do Mocha. There's so many great craft chocolate makers now. We'd be honored if you tried ours, but try ours up against one of those bars. When you taste that dollar bar, it's going to taste like sugar. And so, but as far as the bean quality goes, you know, we've been doing tests with beans for 6-7 years. And, we have made a lot of really bad chocolate in the early stages, testing beans to see, well, what does poor fermentation really taste like? Or poor drying methods. You know, I recently brought back a lot. It was a sample that was given to us, and it had been dried using wood-fired ovens. So smoke had contaminated the cocoa beans. And the chocolate tasted like smoked, it almost tasted like bacon or something. And, but you can taste the defective beans when it's at a high percentage of cocoa. So a 70%, 80% dark bar made with poor beans, you're going to really identify that. But if it's made with, 11 or 18%, whatever that legal minimum is now in the U.S., it's not really going to be detectable.
Mm-hmm. And so, a good bar tastes like?
Oh, gosh. There's so much. The range is incredible. So you can have fruit notes. The bar we have in front of us, the cocoa is from Tanzania, a really beautiful growing co-op called Coco Camilli. And their beans have a cherry tone to them. We don't add any cherry flavoring to that chocolate. The base itself has that unique fruit-like characteristic, because ultimately it is a fruit. Our beans that we're really proud of bringing back from Cameroon, the farmer and dear friend Stanley and I worked hard to ferment them to get them just to be almost like that classic chocolatey taste. It almost tastes like slightly malted cherry, a little nutty note, just really brilliant flavors. The beans that we source from Sierra Leone, they taste like nougat, almost baked brownie. So you have a ton of different different flavor potentials in cocoa.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it was last year you released not only a Cameroon chocolate, but a Cameroon coffee. And so what are some of why is it a big deal that there's Cameroon chocolate and Cameroon coffee out there?
Great. It's a big deal because there's thousands of growers growing these beans, and they're doing a really great job. And I love it when I see their beans in the market. There's a big disadvantage, though. West Africa in general, but Cameroon even more specifically, isn't known for coffee. It's just a small country. In the growing region, it's very high elevation and very good, but it's very small. So from a percentage standpoint, Cameroon coffee is a low volume in the coffee market. And so we made it a point to introduce that bean, as well as our chocolate bar made of Cameroonian cocoa. And just really love the farmers that we're working with and the flavor of that crop. And one other point is the status of it. Neither of those are organic certified. And I love just sharing the story around the organic practices that the farmers are going through, working really hard to achieve organic grade cocoa and coffee. Mm-hmm. And I get asked about price often and that certification. And so, there's a whole other side to uncertified coffee and uncertified organic cocoa. Certifications are really important. We see them on the packages. They immediately tell us the story. It was grown organically and it was traded fairly. And that's really important. The principles of those certifications are really important. The downside to some of that is they leave farmers who are going through those organic and fair trade methods but can't afford those certifications with much less of a market for their crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so we buy coffee from 3,700 farmers in Cameroon, and they're not organic certified, even though they're growing really great organic coffee. There's a few coffee estates in Cameroon who could afford that certification, and it's one person owning that entire plantation. So the wealth distribution is much less. they got the certification, and now the market responds well to that coffee. Meanwhile, there's a large number of farmers who are at a disadvantage without that certification.
Mm-hmm. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, like this example with the organic but not able to accept or afford the label of organic feels like a good example of stepping in, lifting others up, but not stepping all over what's going on. And so to other chocolate and coffee producers, what are some kind of like guiding principles or maybe practices that you turn back to when, you know, kind of reconciling Mocha's growth with just sustainable practices on their farms?
So where you source your ingredients, you should disclose it, and you should work with, you know, importers that are getting beans directly from the producers and can really showcase that transparency. Going to origin is expensive and it's hard. Buying directly is challenging as well. Starting your own farm is like the ultimate, crazy example. But there's ways to express ethics and transparency by doing your job and sourcing from really good suppliers of cocoa and coffee beans here. And when, I think the last kind of point to that is when you do that, you'll be able to, start to really tell a story and showcase that this isn't just a product. This is a story. This is a really important part of a grower's life, and this is the end point of that. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to make sure we take those steps and do that. And I think when I think of the price of coffee and chocolate, it's not going to help your price. You know, buying bulk, commodity grade beans is much more affordable, and it's how you can get profitable as a coffee or chocolate company. And if that's ultimately your goal, then that's where a lot of the commodity market chocolate and coffee are headed. We made it a point that wasn't our intention. It's not even why we're in existence as a company. And we kind of took the hard way. And I really think that it's great that, you know, other craft chocolate makers and coffee roasters are doing that as well, mm-hmm. putting that first.
Yeah. So last year, FedEx kind of recognized the hard work you're doing and uplifted you by awarding you a grant. And so can you give us an example in this past year where you were now faced with this opportunity for huge growth, but also how do you scale just sustainable practices from, you know, your small coffee roaster that you once had to something insane?
Sure. Well, we started our business with some very tightly defined core values. And I think just sticking to those is going to let us stay in line, align our growth with those original intentions. And so a lot of them are revolving around our sourcing practices, sourcing from either producers directly or from producer groups that work with farmers directly, and making sure we can see that transparent trade happening. The other is on our own farm in Cameroon, sticking with our commitment to continue to plant thousands of trees every year, creating employment while we do that, and linking that to our consumers' orders. So we have this fun policy that every order plants a tree. And partially it's because the revenue allows us to do that, but it's also just a way to link the consumer's order and their awareness to that, oh wow, my chocolate is made from a bean that grew onto a tree from a farmer's really hard work over the course of 5 to 10 years. It's an educational piece that really plugs them in directly. The third thing is to take people to origin with us. And so as we spend, you know, almost half of our time overseas at our partnering farms, we love the opportunity for everyone to come and join us. And you could be a chocolate lover, a coffee lover, or just want to have an opportunity to explore off the beaten path places where the practices that we're putting in play in context of chocolate and coffee mean the world of a difference to people 5,000 miles away. So our Origin Trip series launched last year and allows people to travel with us to kind of see our work in action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the website, seeing that your purchase goes to the planting of a tree feels like a very direct equivalency for the consumer. And so as we close, like, let's say our listeners are going to the grocery store and they're so motivated to support a craft coffee or chocolate purveyor, when they are scanning the different varieties, what should they be considering? What should they have faith that those their dollars are going towards?
So look for, small batch. Look for bean to bar. Dig a little bit deeper and see if the maker can tell you where they came from. Not just the country, but the region. Not just the region, but maybe the producer group, or in some cases even the farmer. Look for signs of traceability, and then even the varieties of coffee and cocoa. These are fruits that are growing, so you can really get closely connected with the agricultural side of coffee and chocolate as well. So just these things are indicators that there's a lot more to this product than just a price auction at a commodity level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I might be a cynic, but when I see those farmer profiles, part of me is like, what am I supposed to do with that information? Like, I appreciate the brand's traceability and their values are there, their heart is there, and they're using the right things to prop them up. But how is the consumer to use that information?
I think they can use it to just acknowledge that the people in that supply chain, so the chocolate maker or the coffee roaster, is trying their best to showcase transparency. I don't think it's a perfect solution either, nor do I. The certifications that we see on all of our packages don't necessarily have the answer either. But I think that their principles kind of underlining those attempts that are working in the right direction.
Thank you for joining me today, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Coral. Huge pleasure.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.